What I wanted to talk about this evening, and also maybe have a chance for us to discuss, and also what I'd like to probably talk about for the next few weeks that I'm here, is to talk about more, if you can believe it, about self and no self in Buddhism or in practice in our life. And it's been on my mind a lot lately, and I think it's a well-warranted topic for us to explore for a while. And I thought, I don't know how long it will... I thought of making it the theme, but I thought it could be the theme for at least the next couple of three times that I'm here. I'm here next week, and then I'm gone for a week, and then I come back. So we'll do it for a while until, you know, we get tired of it and we're ready for something else. The teaching of self and no self in the Buddhist tradition, and I think in other traditions also, is considered to be one of the very important areas, some people would say the mysteries, to help us understand our life in a deep way and to help us become free or liberated. And in the Buddhist tradition, there are the three characteristics which are often talked about, one of them being no self, another one being suffering, and the other one being impermanence. And these are three, considered in a sense, three different gates, doorways through which a person can experience a greater and greater freedom, awakening. And there's a lot to be said about all three, but the subject of self is the one that perplexed the most people, the Buddhist teaching of no self. And it isn't simply people who have contact with Buddhist teachings that are perplexed by the Buddhist teachings of self and no self. Buddhists are perplexed by it. And but also, if you read modern psychological studies, what psychologists are doing, anthropologists, sociologists, brain researchers are doing, in their explorations of this notion we have that of the self, something that seems so ingrained. We all have a self, right? And it's very important, and we defend it, and we build it, and we interact with other selves, and it seems so central to who we are. And modern research in all these different scientific fields are coming to some of the similar, even more perplexing conclusions than Buddhism has come to. That maybe it's not what it appears on first appearances. It's not what it seems to be at first appearances. The notion of self, without any serious reflection about it, the common sense that we have, oh, I am here, I'm an I, I'm a self, we often take for granted, so much so that I think it's kind of like the water that fish swim in. I guess fish aren't supposed to notice the water they're in. You know, our ocean that we swim in, most of us, is the ocean of self. And if you do any bit of paying attention to the kinds of thoughts you have, you might notice that probably most of us, the majority of our thoughts, have something to do with self, me, mine, I. How are people thinking about me? How do they see me? Am I adequate enough? Am I fooling them enough? You know, do they like this Dharma talk that I'm giving? You know, there's all this kind of self, you know, and you know, self-reflective thoughts, which are very, very common in our mind. And self-reflective thoughts imply, I believe, some perhaps unconscious notion of that there's a self there, that there's an I. And ideas, there's a kind of a constellation of ideas associated with this kind of thing called an I. And for most people, they never think about it. They never reflect on what this is. They take it for granted for a whole lifetime. And I think it's very valuable to study not only Buddhism, but maybe more so some of the modern research being done in this self concept, the notion of self. One that's been in my mind a little bit the last couple of days, reading the newspapers, has to do with single gendered schools. You know, there's a woman in Portola Valley who wants to start a girls, is it junior high school, technical school, computer school, technology school for girls, junior high school, and in the news today they were talking about Pete Wilson is trying very hard to get California to start single-sex school system, not the whole thing, but to have options so people can send their kids to all boys and all girls schools. And some of the thinking behind it is that our scholastic, our social, our family conditioning around our gender lines has a big impact on our self-concept, our self-identity, and who we think we are and what we can do. And that, you know, if the teacher constantly is calling on the guys and is not calling on the gals, then perhaps the women get the impression that what they have to say isn't really worthwhile, or they're not really smart enough. The guys are the ones who are smart, or something like that, right? You've read the studies. And so we internalize some of the notions that our society has about the kind of person we are. And that enters into this constellation of this idea of the self, of who we are and our identity. And it's much more malleable than most of us realize, the notion of a self. I think when we're in the midst of our own self, we think it's pretty absolute and pretty permanent, and this is the way we are, this is the way it is. And whether we believe that consciously or not, we often act that way unconsciously. And it's much more malleable, it's much more conditioned, and changeable than meets the eye at first glance. And one of the ways we can see this is if you've ever been the recipient of someone's projection on who they think you are, they have a concept of who you are, who that self that you are. And so they have this idea, they see you through the filter of their concept, their idea, their identification. And it can be very uncomfortable to be the recipient of that. Once upon a time you got angry with someone, and you're hardly ever angry, but you happen to get angry. And every time you meet that person thinks that you're an angry person. They put you in that category, and they relate to you that way. And they kind of keep their distance or whatever. Or a common one is, your sense of self, your identification society, is conditioned on your spouse. So people see you because you're married to so-and-so. And so, that's a very uncomfortable position to be in because, they don't see you then necessarily. And so, many people in our society have been the recipients of being categorized and limited and feeling that it's, not only disrespectful, but it's very limiting and painful, because it means the person doesn't really see you for who you are, but rather seeing you through an idea. Another way we can see how the self-concept is quite problematic for people is we see how people internalize it for themselves. We see it in our friends and people around us. They have a fixed idea of who they are, and us being kind of objective and kind of look outside and say, realize they're not necessarily that way. If someone might feel like they're the most unworthy person on the block, the dumbest person on the block, or the ugliest person, or just have very, very strong ideas about who we are. And we go around living on that, and our friends will tell us, get off it, it's okay, you're a lot better than that, you're not so bad. And often what happens with ourselves is we might pick up on one particular theme, which for some reason is really hot for us, and see ourselves and measure ourselves through this one theme: our physical appearance, our intelligence, our status, our wealth, our jobs, or something, our success. And we can get quite miserable because we don't have enough money, and not notice that we're totally generous and warm and friendly to our friends and can take care of them and compassionate. And our friends just love us, but we can't believe they love us because, we don't have enough money, and that's the measure of what really is active self. And there's notions, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't succeed, I'm not good enough, I'm unworthy, are epidemic in our society. It isn't just kind of, I'm just kind of casually giving you a few examples there. It's really, I think, epidemic in American culture. So we can see it oftentimes in our friends and people around us. The third area, which is most difficult to see it, is in ourselves. It's very hard to see in ourselves the self-concepts, the self-ideas, the ideas of self that we've kind of constellated ourselves around. It's interesting that one of the definitions that some modern psychoanalysts or psychologists have for the self, which could perhaps be kind of very close to a Buddhist concept, is the self is the organizing principle, organizing center around which we understand our experience, the way we organize our experience. So there's no like some absolute thing there. It has to do with how we take all these different experiences and organize them into one thing. And that's, if we realize that that's why it's an organizing principle, it's something that's quite malleable. The organizing principle changes depending on what you have to organize. So maybe you change depending on how you have to organize things. When I was 17, 18, I used to hitchhike around Europe. And, it was a time in my life where I was just kind of trying to find myself and kind of get a sense of who I was. And one of the things I discovered that I could do, or that I did, maybe I should be more embarrassed than I am about this, but is I would go, hitchhiking around, and, I would see this person for half an hour, and I'd never see them again, or however long the ride took. And so I started trying out different identities. Just to see what they'd be like, and to get kind of, explore that world of identities and what it meant to have an identity and what it meant to kind of relate to people through different identities. And it was quite fun, to do that and kind of, and I got a better sense of who I actually was by playing those games, role-playing, I guess. And I guess I was lying, but, it didn't bother me so much at the time. So how do we limit ourselves by our self-concept? So how are some of the ways that you all have found yourself limited by the self-concept you have had for yourself, that you've had in the past or you still have now? That's just a concept and not necessarily who you are. Who wants to be brave? Whose self-concept allows them to? Could you give us a small example?
Could you repeat the question?
The question is, can you give some examples of ways in which you are or have been limited by some self-concept that you've had?
No, I meant
her answer. And her answer was that she found herself, she limits herself sometimes when she has used the past, what she's done in the past or who she's been in the past, to measure herself today or now. So then I asked her to kind of, if she can give a small example of that. And it's hard to be on the spot, but
oh, I can give a large example.
If you
in the past I would be I would do something that was dishonest, or I would do something that was limiting of myself. And then somebody would see me poorly, and I would carry that around as my own idea.
Good for you, yeah.
I'm a little embarrassed, but yeah, I lied, or I had affairs with married people, or I've done things that were damaging to others, and not even.
So rather than seeing it being one event, it becomes part of your identity, who I am.
Because that's how somebody sees me, that must be how I am.
So how many of you think that your sense of self was born or was created, influenced by how other people have seen you? So, what does that say about no self? Holly.
Well, I don't know if this is exactly it, but I made myself very uncomfortable with gluing eyeballs onto my picture name tag ID at work, and it's like a big deal. You get wherever you go. Those little doll things you can get with the people that stand there. And I've been really getting a kick out of it. Nobody knows that I have to point it out to people. Go to the locked psych unit. And then I felt really uncomfortable.
Elaine.
I found that age has been a determiner of how I thought of myself. And the changes that are necessary as I, in fact, do so are generally uncomfortable. And more they're pointing out to me the question, well, who am I really? As some things have to draw, but other things don't have to. And it raises some questions about who I've been all along.
That's a wise thing. How many of you find that your aging challenges your self-concept? Yes.
I went through several bad depressions, and I began to see myself as a very moody and tortured person. And I found that as long as I thought of myself as a moody and tortured person, I was the moody and tortured person. And the minute I realized that I saw myself that way and I stopped being a moody and tortured person. So I realized my sense of self was very self-determined.
Yes.
Could you explain to me what you mean by you stop? What was the alternative?
Well, I realized that I kept myself moody and tortured. That I found problems in everything because I thought there were problems in everything, and it took time, but it was just changing how I looked at the world and how I looked at the world in regards to me, that I didn't have to be tortured, you know, that it was something that I put upon myself, and that it life doesn't, there's one, what was it, Sylvia Borstein said, pain is inevitable, but suffering is
optional.
Right, and I was diving right into the suffering, and I found that it was optional. And so by not looking at myself as moody and tortured, I wasn't anymore.
Yes?
Kind of on a similar type of thing, I used to, when I was working full time, I'd be so focused on my work, I'd be very happy. People would always say to me, God, why are you happy all the time? What's your secret, you know? And I thought I was, you know, then I'd get home and I'd get into these moods and this stuff. I go, well, my real self is this unhappy person. That's my real self. As long as there was anything negative in me, I identified with that as my real self and thought all that happiness I may have from the day didn't count. That wasn't real. And so that was definitely very limiting, you know, to go, you know, finally hit me at some point, you know, that it was all, know who I was, you know, and none of it was who I was.
Great, thank you. Yes.
Such faces in understanding myself, I never, for much too long a period of time, so long a change of it. I really was very idealistic. I thought that anything I wanted, I could accomplish by just working hard or whatever it took to accomplish it. Of course, I found out at a certain point that was not true. Second thing, beyond that, later on I discovered that I had to be really careful with some things I wanted that I really would not be better off not having. But I'm still learning all this about myself and things I desire.
Yes?
I went through big changes when I became a parent, that it really changed my sense of autonomy, that I used to be sort of a single self, and all of a sudden I had this, like, extension of myself that really depended on me a lot, and I struggle, I kind of push a lot against having to do that. And also going from being like a professional person who made money, suddenly being staying at home and having
no salary for what I did, and I mean, there were lots of changes about either viewing myself less well or, you know, kind of differently. It really made me realize, like, what am I? How did it all change?
Yes.
My mother passed away recently, several months ago, and I'm finding now that my sense of myself is changing as a result of not being a daughter. My father passed away many, many years ago, but I was also the youngest one in my family, and so there's this sense of whole new roles and possibilities opening to me, and I'm sort of astounded what was limited by, you know, being with a daughter and child, and now as a child.
Yes.
I think my negative sense of self was nurtured by my mother, who wanted me to feel good about myself. And so it took me to piano lessons and dancing lessons and art lessons, trying to find something she thought I could do really well at, and make me feel good about
it. Yes.
Well, my sense of self recently changed greatly. I was adopted and recently found my biological family. And to say that your family has, you know, and your friends have a great influence on yourself is understated, because when I found my biological family, my whole sense of self flew out the window. And it's been an incredible journey, discovering who I was or am and what I'm not.
So perhaps we begin seeing that, you know, that how much it's possible to limit ourselves, to be constrained, and actually for many of us to suffer unduly based on the internalization or the adoption of a certain kind of view or idea of who we are, an idea of a self. So Buddhism focuses a lot on self. And as you know, and this strange thing called no-self, which means different things in different corners of Buddhism, different kind of traditions. And it means one thing if you study the teachings of the Buddha, how he used it. And it means perhaps something a little bit different in the world of Vipassana teaching and Vipassana practice. And as we go through these weeks, I want to maybe kind of touch on the different ways in which it's meant here in the Buddhist tradition. But if we see that, one of the things that's important to understand about it is that no self doesn't exist. It's not like, you know, there's a no self and you can point to it. There's my no self. You know, meet my good friend, my no self. The no self is like, it's something like it doesn't exist. It's like, you know, I don't know, what's a good example of something? It's not really the opposite, you know, because a non-existent thing can't really be the opposite of something, right? I would argue in this thing. But the question is, which is the non-existent thing? Is your concepts of self the existent thing or the non-existent thing? Or is no self the existing thing or the non-existent thing? And some of us have found out that some of our concepts don't have much bearing on what's really true. And in a sense, we carried around this this concept which wasn't really pointing to anything really real. And so it was pointing at something non-existent, but we were living through this illusion of a non-existent thing which we thought existed and with which we then organized our life around. One example, to give you an example for myself that maybe I've said, maybe all of you have heard this before, but in seventh grade, I had an art class, and our teacher told me that I had no artistic talent. Can you imagine telling someone in junior high school they have no artistic talent? So she knows, and I don't know, and, you know, it must be true. And so I went through the rest of high school kind of thinking, well, I have no artistic talent. There's no reason for me to do any art. And then I went to college, and my roommate in the freshman year was a born-again artist. And he felt that everyone should be doing art. And so he, in his kind of very kind of, you know, gentle way, kind of seduced me or kind of pulled me into the world of art. And by the end of the school year, I was taking art classes and drawing classes. And then the next year, I became an art major so that I could take... I wasn't going to become an artist. I was going to take art. But in order to take classes, you have to be an art major. So I just signed up to be an art major so I can take the classes. So I had a great time for about a year. I took three quarters of art classes. And after a year, I decided that I was going to be an artist. And there was a big difference to just kind of doing art because, you know, you enjoy it and just it was bubbling up inside of me, and doing it because you're an artist. So what I found was when I decided that my identity was to be an artist, you know, once you have that identity, you have to, you know, prop it up, right? And in one way, you know, you can get a beret and, a, you know, so you would there's, you know, various, you know, if I, you know, but I wasn't smart enough. I didn't realize there were all these kind of other ways to do it. So I, excuse me, get carried away here. What I did was I felt like I had to do art in order to be the artist. And the day I decided to be an artist was the day I stopped doing art, because I couldn't do it just to prop up my identity. So the notion of self, the opposite of our self-concept that we get preoccupied with, we get stuck in, we get limited by, we get attached to, I would say the opposite of that is not no self. Because no self is a non-existent thing. It doesn't, you know, a non-existent thing shouldn't be the opposite. You know, the opposite of one is not zero, it's minus one, right? So anyway. But anyway, so the opposite is not a zero, it's not nothing. So if you're willing to accept this premise, then my question for you is, what is the opposite of self? But that leaves you out.
All inclusive, interdependent.
All inclusive. Okay. What else?
Or as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, no independent self.
No independent self. Now, when you answer, we have a ground rule for you answering, and that is you can't give any negative answers, and that would be a negative answer.
So all inclusive.
Okay. Yes?
I would say it's what's left after all the trappings of ego and personality are not there.
Yeah.
When there is no thought, no memory.
Now, that's still a negative answer.
But it's what's left.
Oh, but still, that's a little bit, you know, it's on the edge there. Yeah, what's left?
Sense of self that underlies all other senses.
Freedom. Okay, freedom is a dangerous one because it's kind of I'm not going to accept it for the right. You know, I'm sitting in this game. I can accept and reject answers, and I'm not going to accept that one because it's too abstract.
Emptiness.
So you two get to try again. Yes.
Interconnectedness.
It's okay.
Presence.
Presence. I like that one. Yes.
Us.
In a sense.
Awareness.
But. It's parallel. Well, in a sense, it could be. Maybe there's many opposites, but it seems to leave you out. So, you know, what?
Leave you out.
Doesn't leave me out, but.
What means the opposite of I? I mean, I don't know. I just think it seems like it would be us, because then it would be not just.
So, I think it's a fair answer, but it's not what I'm trying to get at. So maybe you know, just making the rules as I go along. It's like a Calvin ball. Process. Okay. Shay?
Well, is unself-consciousness, is that a negative?
Yeah, it's a negative. I'm sorry.
Awareness.
Okay. But awareness seems so limited. I mean, we're much more than awareness, aren't we? I mean, so who are we? So the question is this way: who are we? If who we are is the opposite of this self concept, who are we if we're not the self concept? If we're not self.
Intention.
Okay, that's a good. Jean.
So you said the self is the organizing principle of for understanding our experience, but to me the opposite of the self would be the experience.
Okay, that's fine. You know, part of the awkwardness of this kind of questioning, which I admit, is that there's many ideas of what self is. So depending on what you start with as your premise, you get something different. But I'm kind of talking here about this the sense of self, the self concept, self identity, which tends to limit us, which tends to be attachment. And so
the universe.
Okay.
Acceptance. Art.
Art. I like that. Do you hear that? Okay.
A boundless mind.
Less is kind of negative. Yes.
Same concept, maybe openness.
Okay.
Creativity.
Okay.
There was only self.
Sorry?
There was only self.
Only self. Why are we
assuming it? We don't have to, but the opposite of that self-concept, which is self-limiting, which limits us, which gets us in trouble. That we, you know, when I asked you, many of you, you know, about your self-concept, many of them were kind of painful and very limiting, and people saw how you can kind of, you're more than that or different than that. The point of this exercise is not to get, you know, the answer. So you can be kind of relaxed about it. Yes.
The idea that it's always changing, that it's always impermanent, that when you get in trouble is when you sort of think of yourself in a certain way.
Uh-huh.
That's a certain outcome, or have a certain view of how people should see you, or how you should be seen, and it's none of that.
So change.
Mystery.
Reality.
Sorry?
Reality.
Reality. It's a little bit too abstract for me. Yeah, but do you know what is that? What? Sorry? The fable is that. No, I don't. I think that's not such a good answer.
How about everything?
Well, yeah.
I've got the universe.
Yes.
How about simply being?
Being is good. Wait a minute. I'm the one who's approving them. What? One's more than enough, isn't it? Steve?
Gil, what does it mean that being is good?
Yes. Yeah.
If you could communicate it, it probably would be such a good mystery. How does one just feel after hard work? Or I don't know how you get there.
What do you feel after hard work?
Well, I don't know. It's just, you probably can't really communicate it. Uh-huh. Why are you sitting here meditating and trying to get there?
That's a good response. And if you all were Zen students, you know, if you were well trained in Zen, actually, the Zen students that I know here haven't answered yet, so. Now, that either means they answered, and they know it's their way of answering, or with Zen, they wouldn't settle for an answer which was an about, an explanation. But rather, what they'd want is an enactment. The opposite of a concept of self is action, is enactment. So the intention that someone said was, it gets close to that, but it's still a little bit removed because it's still explaining it. So I did the same exercise at Tassajara last week when I was down there. And the older Zen students there kind of held their tongue. I guess they didn't want to embarrass themselves. But afterwards, they kind of came up to me on the sly and said, well, you know, what I meant is... And one of them said, and he was kind of the host, and he said, well, you know, what I wanted to do was offer you a glass of water as an answer to that question. Mm-hmm. And I would have bowed to that answer. So the idea of the opposite of self maybe is not a concept, it's not an idea. And so everything in the universe is a little bit too abstract. But it's an engagement, it's an action, it's an involvement. Maybe it's, sometimes I think of the opposite of the sense of self is what is the body, so what goes through the body, the lived body, the body being everything. So it's what we live, it's the lived experience of our life. And so it's how we live and what we do, not what we think about it. So the trick in Buddhism, in a sense, and the whole part of the function of the teaching of no self is to help us to switch from living a life that's about, an aboutness kind of life. You know, in a lot of what we tell ourselves about ourselves is aboutness. We tell ourselves that we're, you know, I'm about job success, I'm about material success, I'm about relational success, I'm a failure, whatever. We have all these concepts. Those concepts are concepts about who we are. And as long as we're preoccupied with the aboutness of our life, I would argue that each moment of aboutness is a lost opportunity about isness, about kind of doing and being. And, you know, now, being and doing, you know, can be done naively and get us in trouble. It should be some self-reflection there, some mindfulness there. But there's also the lived experience. And the lived experience is often where our freedom is found. I would argue that our freedom is not found in the abstract. It's not found in an idea about freedom. But if Stephen had acted his freedom for us here, but he's not a Zen student, so... It was okay, and if he was really wise, he would say, well, you know, actually it was, you know, I was acting when I said that, and it gets, you know, very subtle, so I should maybe bow to him. And Sorry.
I get a sense of control being in about
an
illusion, but.
So this is interesting. So if a lot of us, if we accept a certain psychologist's definition of self, it's the organizing principle of our experience, that can shade over and become the controlling principle of our experience. And there's maybe, I would say there's a big difference between a controlling of our experience and organizing of it. Organizing is kind of a natural thing that happens. Yes?
We identify ourselves by saying, well, I'm a mother, I'm a CEO, I'm a this. Well, the question is, who are you really? We're identifying ourselves by who we have become by virtue of outside.
Right. That's accurate. And what
is the deeper question then, who are you really?
That's
not
a good
identifying, I'm a mother, I'm a doctor, I'm a this, I'm a that. Well, so what?
Yes, that's a good way of saying it. And there's, you know, and this, you know, and the answer to that, or the, you know, the ways to explore that can be many varied. Mm-hmm. One of the ways which some people like to talk is that when you're mothering, then you're a mother. So we identify us by ourselves by our action, and not by the description, not by the noun. So I am now mothering, rather than saying I am a mother. And so, in a sense, of course, you know, once you're a mother, perhaps you're a mother for a while, or say, you know, you're a CEO, and so, you know, to assume that who I am is a CEO, and then you go home to your spouse, and he says, you know, get off it, you know, please give me a break, you know, we don't need another CEO here at home, you do, but I'm a CEO, it's very important, what, you know, so. So, you know, so our who we are what we're doing, in a sense.
And then the deeper question beyond that would then be, you know, I am this, I am that, I am that, but what I really am is a bodhisattva, or I am a child of God.
Yes.
Which is really the real answer, but it's buffered by all these this worldly stuff.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, that's
what you're asking is very, very important, that exploration. And what my sense, I hope, as we go through these kind of Monday evenings now, where we explore self, is that we take it really as an exploration and to look at different angles and different perspectives, rather than thinking we're supposed to come to the answer. What I find in myself and also in many people who are involved in Buddhist practice, and perhaps many people involved in all kinds of spiritual practices, the kind of what is perhaps a fallacy. The fallacy that there kind of maybe be called the essentialist fallacy, that there's some essential it that is the answer. I can find the real self or the real no self or the real it or the real answer or the real ultimate experience. And it's like one thing, and if you can just find that and get to that, then everything else is taken care of. It's like one thing. And I feel myself in my exploration of all this that more and more that there isn't such a thing. And there are, of course, wonderful things and realizations that can happen, but to set them up as being the end, as this is it, is to do ourselves a disservice, is actually to limit ourselves again anew. So one of the ways to look at the notion of self, to kind of begin loosening up our concepts, is to use the analogy of the wave particle discussion in physics. You know, is light a wave or is it a particle? And it's both, right? Depending, either or both or something, or who knows what it is. It depends what angle you look at and how you're measuring. And so I think this analogy is very useful for understanding the sense of who we are as a self. That sometimes we can see ourselves from a certain angle as a particle and sometimes as a wave. And Buddhism tends to emphasize the point of view more, tends to focus more on the wave side, the change and the flow, and other things. Sometimes psychology or psychoanalysis will focus more on the particle side, or the West, you know, or social self focus more on the particle side of things. And both are important, but you don't want to set up one as being the answer. So part of all this is exploration. And one of my, as many of you know, my favorite quote in Buddhism is Zen Master's Dogen quote, to study Buddhism is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self, and to forget the self is to awaken with all things, or to be confirmed by all things. And what I like this for many reasons, but one reason is that the premise is he starts with to study Buddhism to study the self. And it's really the exploration of ourself. Who are we? What is my self-concept? How do I bring myself into the world and engage myself? And to explore the ways we limit ourselves, the way we hold ourselves back, the way we get attached, the way we free ourselves, the way we act creatively and whatever. To get to know this really well, in that activity, then we find a disappearing of self-consciousness. And in that loss of self-consciousness, who we are is actually actualized by the universe, by all things. But we don't start with the premise of no self. We don't start by being self-denying. We don't start with some kind of ideal of who we should be. We start with actually who we are and get to know it really well. So really, I hope the task for us as we go through these next few weeks is really kind of to come up and bump up against all the different ways in which we have notions of self and kind of see how it operates in our life and become more mindful of that. And that's more important, really, I believe, than understanding the notion of no self. No self has importance to understand or to realize. So it isn't that like there's one answer to all this, because perhaps, you know, if you realize that the sense of self changes and is malleable and moves all the time, and maybe it's an organizing principle, it has to be there to some kind of degree. Then it's an ongoing process to understand it. And so Buddhist practice or mindfulness practice doesn't have an end. You know, it's not like you come to an end, and that's it. But rather, it's something we do continually, because we continually recreate ourselves and rediscover ourselves and re-find ourselves. So, it's 9 o'clock. Yes?
Two thoughts that I have. The first one is, it's a very old concept that I studied when I was studying drama and art in school, which is that there are no artists. There are craftsmen occasionally creating art. And then there's the idea that I struggle with now. Because in my life I've done so many things and been so, it seems easy for me that the idea that I'm this person now because I'm doing this, and 10 minutes later I'm doing something else, that was very easy. It kind of flowed into me. But the problem of self and other, that the stuff that happens is happening to me, and the idea that maybe there's something out there doing it, and therefore something bad happens, then why is this happening to me?
Oh. You know,
why did my father know?
I see.
Why did I? And there are the times that I'm better and better as a person, I think, are the times when the stuff happens, and so it's happened when I deal with it, rather than the times that I worry about why me. If I forget about the why me, I always do better then. And it's the little things that are the worst. Why was the person I was working with angry at me? Why me in particular? That are the hardest. The big things are easy. The small things are the hardest.
Sometimes small things are actually big. I mean, I say that because they often, it's a small thing, sometimes they get really in there to the core issues sometimes. Yes?
You were talking about describing oneself in terms of process, mothering or EOing or whatever. And I've been interested to see, when I've experimented with that I get a lot of resistance from people. But it's hard to have a regular conversation that people sort of won't receive that. They quickly turn it into the now.
No.
I'm painting. Oh, you're an artist. I mean, that happens very quickly, and it's interesting to see that. Just from the outside, that people sort of have the need to have
not
be a process.
People want to put us in, you know, to understand us. It's kind of normal. Maybe it's not such a. It might not be a bad thing in and of itself, but it becomes a bigger and bigger thing than people put us in a category. So, you know, we just be patient. Kind of, you know, okay. You can say that if you want. So, and part of, you know, this exploration of self happens naturally as we sit, and I think sitting or mindfulness practice is a very, very powerful way, because especially in sitting meditation, because as the mind becomes quieter and more stable, we can start actually looking at the kind of the subtle structure that we've built up around self and self-concept. And the deeper and more deeper we can sit, I think the deeper we understand the deep structure of self. So, last question, yes, or comment.
When you say the word self, does that equate with ego?
or is ego something of a subset of self?
Well, you know, this is it's good that you ask this in the sense that it's always good to ask a person for the definition of self when they're using it, because there can be so many different definitions of it. So this evening, I tend to use the notion of self from the point of view of self-concept, and because self-concept is very closely tied into our sense of self. But maybe there's other things that involve sense of self besides self-concept. And so ego, definitely, you know, so what is ego? That needs to be defined also. And ego kind of popularly is maybe understood as being egotistical by some people. So that which is, you know, which is very closely tied again to our self-concept. So I enjoyed myself tonight. I hope that you found it lively. And please, which self did it? All the selves. And one of the descriptions of a meditation hall is that it's considered to be a garbage dump. It's a place where you can kind of dump your all those extra concepts and just leave them behind and go about your life. So please leave them, you know, leave whatever you want behind, and it'll dissipate by the time you come back next Monday. Thank you all.